So what have we learned so far? That there are no heroes and no villains. Everybody's a villain, actually, to put it better. The United States decided to use the ethnic tensions in Afghanistan to inflame Muslims against the Soviet Union, which eventually led to a 10-year war during the 80s in Afghanistan between Russia and Afghanistan, or the Soviet Union versus Afghanistan. We've learned that the United States has been responsible for training many of the members of the people now called Al-Qaeda, and that the Al-Qaeda people have learned how to use to manipulate the United States' interest so that they could get the training, they could get education. I mean, America tried to propagandize against the Russians and by inflaming ethnic tensions. So we helped set up what happened. And we've shown that the Osama bin Laden and his associates, like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, have been involved for a long time in acts against against our country because they hate us. And we have acted, we've been pushing people around. The bully on the playground is the metaphor or analogy that works best for me, that we go around manipulating other people and not thinking that it would have any effect on us. We've seen how we were manipulated, too, as pro-Al-Qaeda, pro-Islamic fundamentalism sects set up in the United States. There was even a sleeper cell in Anaheim, folks. That's Disneyland. And we have seen how it's arisen ideas on how to commit terrorist acts. Bin Laden was very impressed by the 1982 bombing of a Marine barracks in Beirut, which Bin Laden apparently had nothing to do with himself. But when all those Marines died, within a week or so, the U.S. had pulled out of Lebanon. And that taught that terrorist activities could affect the United States. The timeline has gone up to the World Trade Center bombing in 1993. We pick up in 1994. January 24, 1994, the Boston Herald reports that an internal CIA report has concluded that the agency is, quote, partially culpable for the 1993 World Trade Center bombing because it helped train and support some of the bombers. One source with knowledge of the report says it was determined that a significant amount of blowback appeared to have occurred. Blowback, that's their word. A U.S. intelligence source claims that the CIA gave at least $1 billion to forces in Afghanistan connected to Gulbuddin Hekmatyar. More than a half dozen of the World Trade Center bombers belonged to this faction, and some of the CIA money paid for their training. The source says, by giving these people the funding that we did, a situation was created in which it could be safely argued that we bombed the World Trade Center. No false flag terrorism. We bombed them. We bombed ourselves by arming and supplying money and training to the very people who did the act. Those connected to the bombing who went to Afghanistan included Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman, Clement Rodney Hampton L., Siddig Siddig Ali, Ahmet Ajag, and Mahmoud Abuhalima. Additionally, Ramzi Youssef trained in Afghanistan near the end of the Afghan War, and there are claims that he was recruited by the CIA. Intelligence sources say the CIA used the Al-Kifa Refugee Center in Brooklyn, founded to support the Afghani rebels fighting Soviet occupation, to funnel aid to Hekmatyar, setting the stage for terrorists here to acquire the money, guns, and training needed to later attack the Trade Center. CIA support also made it easier for alleged terrorist leaders to enter the country. March 13, 1994. The New York Times reports that tens of thousands of Islamic radicals from around the world have come to train in Afghanistan since the end of the Soviet-Afghan War in order to bring the militant jihad struggle back to their home country. There are dozens of training camps all over the country, with around 20 under control of warlord Gulbuddin Hekmatyar alone. Even though bin Laden is living in Sudan at this time and has moved some training camps there, he also keeps some camps and guest houses open in Pakistan and Afghanistan until he moves back to Afghanistan to take direct control of them in 1996. A civil war that has raged nonstop since the Soviets left, and the growing importance of the opium crop made Afghanistan into essentially a lawless country. There is no civil law, no government, no economy, only guns and drugs and anger. Abdul Haq, a politically moderate warlord, says, "For us, Afghanistan is destroyed. It is turning to poison. And not only for us, but for all others in the world. If you are a terrorist, you can have shelter here, no matter who you are. Day by day, there is the increase of drugs. Maybe one day the United States will have to send hundreds of thousands of troops to deal with that. And if they step in, they will be stuck. We have a British grave in Afghanistan. We have a Soviet grave in Afghanistan. And then we will have an American grave." April 94. Disgruntled worker tries to fly passenger jet into a Memphis building. A flight engineer at Federal Express, who is facing a potentially career-ending disciplinary hearing, boards a DC-10 as a passenger, storms the cockpit with a hammer, and hits each of the three members of the cockpit crew in the head. He severely injures all of them, but they nonetheless are able to wrestle him down and regain control of the plane. Company employees claim he was trying to hit a company building in Memphis, Tennessee. See, nobody thought this would happen. April 94, CIA suspects U.S. ambassador may be involved in arms smuggling. U.S. Ambassador Peter Galbraith speaks with Ayman Sefko Omar Basic, a religious leader of a small Muslim community in Zagreb, Croatia. Sefko later informs the Iranian ambassador that American diplomats want him to purchase arms for the Bosnian army. So here we are in Bosnia trying to do the same thing again. The CIA keeps tabs on Galbraith, concerned that he might be engaged in a secret operation. The CIA fears that another Iran-Contra scandal is brewing. Shortly after April 9, 1994, bin Laden travels to Albania. He visits Albania as a member of a Saudi government delegation. He is introduced as a friend of the Saudi government who could finance humanitarian projects. Yet, earlier the same month, the Saudi government supposedly cut all ties with bin Laden. One former U.S. intelligence officer will complain in 99, "Why was he a member of that delegation? The Saudis are supposed to be our allies. They told us he was persona non grata, and yet here he was working the crowds on an official visit." Bin Laden strengthens ties with the Albanian Secret Service with an eye to assisting the fight against Serbia in the neighboring country of Bosnia. April 27, 1994. U.S. gives Bosnians green light to smuggle arms. United States President Bill Clinton and National Security Advisor Anthony Lake decide that they will give the Bosnians a green light for the arms supply pipeline from Iran to Croatia. The CIA is not consulted. Lake passes the word on to U.S. Ambassador to Croatia, Peter Galbraith, by cleverly telling him that they have no instructions for him with regard to the Iranian arms shipments. 2 days later, Galbraith passes the no-instructions message on to Croatian President Franjo Tudjman, making it clear that the U.S. government is giving him a green light for Croatia to conduct arms deals with Iran. June 24, 1994, Pentagon report predicts new age of religiously inspired super-terrorism. The Pentagon privately publishes a report called Terror 2000. It is designed to help U.S. intelligence prepare for new terrorism threats. Peter Probst in the Pentagon's Office of the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations and Low-Intensity Conflict supervises the report. The panel consults with 40 experts, including a top Russian intelligence official and a senior Israeli intelligence official. The report concludes that the world is witnessing the dawn of a new age of super-terrorism. It predicts chemical and biological attacks, and says that terrorists will soon try to conduct simultaneous bombings and attacks. Also, in contrast to the state-sponsored terrorism familiar to most Americans at the time, the report says tomorrow's most dangerous terrorists would be motivated not by political ideology, but by fierce ethnic and religious hatreds. Their goal will not be political control, but utter destruction of their chosen enemies. The report further states, we appear to be entering an era in which few, if any, restraints will remain. Unlike politically motivated terrorists, religiously motivated terrorists do not shrink from mass murder. Mass casualties are not to be shunned, but sought, because they demonstrate to unbelievers the cataclysmic nature of divine retribution. It also postulates the use of planes as weapons, but this is not put in the report, partly for fear of giving potential terrorists ideas. The study is presented to officials in Congress, FEMA, the CIA, FBI, NSA, DIA, Justice Department, State Department, and senior executives from the telecommunications, banking, and computer industries. State Department officials consider publicly releasing the report, but ultimately decide not to. That was a mistake, Probst will later say. Marvin Citron, an expert who wrote the report, will later say some of the people thought it was right on, but most of them thought it was too far out. Again, advance notice saying that this is possible. June 95, U.S. considers bombing bin Laden for sponsoring assassination attempt. There is a failed assassination attempt on Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak as he visits Ethiopia. The CIA concludes bin Laden authorized the operation and they plan a retaliation attack. Evidence suggests that the government of Sudan and Hassan al-Turabi, Sudan's leader, know where bin Laden is living and helped support the plot. The United Nations Security Council places sanctions on Sudan as a result. The U.S. examines options for attacking bin Laden and or al-Turabi's facilities in the Sudanese capital. The options developed by the U.S. military are rejected for being unstealthy and a de facto war on Sudan. In the ensuing months, there are reports of Egyptian covert operations against bin Laden and an Egyptian military buildup on the Sudanese border. These factors influence bin Laden's decision to move to Afghanistan in 96. Late 1995, bin Laden said to consider asylum in, of all places, Great Britain. Osama bin Laden is said to be unhappy with his exile in Sudan, where authorities are making noises about expelling him. Consequently, he requests asylum in Britain. Several of his brothers and other relatives, who are members of the bin Laden construction empire, own properties in London. He has already transferred some of his personal fortune to London to help his followers set up terror cells in Britain and across Europe. Bin Laden employs Khalid al-Fawaz, a Saudi businessman described as his de facto ambassador in Britain, to assess his chances of moving there. British Home Secretary Michael Howard later says, in truth, I knew little about him, but we picked up information that bin Laden was very interested in coming to Britain. It was apparently a serious request. After Home Office officials investigate bin Laden, Howard issues an immediate order banning him under Britain's immigration laws. There are also press reports later that bin Laden travels frequently to London around this time. 1996, Al-Qaeda supposedly loses trust in Ali Mohammed. The New York Times will later report that Ali Mohammed runs afoul of the bin Laden organization after 95 because of a murky dispute involving money and is no longer trusted by bin Laden's lieutenants. This is according to a 1999 court testimony from Khalid Abu El-Dahab, the only known member of Mohammed's Santa Clara, California, Al-Qaeda cell. Santa Clara, huh? Another Al-Qaeda operative in another trial will claim that in 94, Al-Qaeda leader Mohammed Atef refused to give Ali Mohammed information because he suspected Ali Mohammed was a U.S. intelligence agent. However, despite these accounts, it seems that Ali Mohammed continues to be given sensitive assignments. For instance, later in 96, he will help bin Laden move from Sudan to Afghanistan. and he will be in contact with many of the operatives in Kenya planning the U.S. Embassy bombing there until 98, the year the bombing takes place. The Associated Press will later comment that it is unclear how Mohammed was able to maintain his terror ties in the 90s without being banished by either side, even after the special forces documents he has stolen turned up in a 95 New York trial. March through May 96, the U.S. and Sudan squabble over bin Laden's fate. The United States demands for Sudan to hand over its extensive files about bin Laden. They escalate into demands to hand over bin Laden himself. Bin Laden has been living in Sudan since 91, at a time when the Sudanese government's ideology was similar to his, but after the U.S. put Sudan on its list of terrorism sponsors and began economic sanctions in 93, Sudan began to change. In 94, it handed the notorious terrorist Carlos the Jackal to France. In March 96, Sudan's defense minister goes to Washington and engages in secret negotiations over bin Laden. Sudan offers to extradite bin Laden to anywhere he might stand trial. Some accounts claim that Sudan offers to hand bin Laden directly to the United States, but the United States decides not to take him because they do not have enough evidence at the time to charge him with a crime. Counterterrorism czar Richard Clark later will call this story a fable invented by the Sudanese and Americans friendly to Sudan. He will point out that bin Laden was an ideological blood brother, family friend, and benefactor to Sudanese leader Hassan al-Turabi. So any offers to hand him over may have been disingenuous. CIA Director George Tenet later will deny that Sudan made any efforts to hand over bin Laden directly to the U.S. The U.S. reportedly asks Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Jordan to accept bin Laden into custody, but is refused by all three governments. The 9/11 Commission later will claim it finds no evidence that Sudan offered bin Laden directly to the U.S., but it does find evidence that Saudi Arabia was discussed as an option. U.S. officials insist that bin Laden leave Sudan for anywhere but Somalia. One U.S. intelligence force in the region will state later, "We kidnap minor drug czars and bring them back in burlap bags." So somebody didn't want this to happen. On May 18th, 1996, bin Laden flies to Afghanistan, but the U.S. does not try to stop him. March 8th, 96 to April 96, U.S. asks Sudan for its files on Al-Qaeda, then declines to accept them. Oh, there's such non-forward thinking, eh? In 93, the U.S. put Sudan on its list of nations sponsoring terrorism, which automatically leads to economic sanctions. Sudanese leader Hassan al-Turabi espoused radical militant views and allowed bin Laden to live in Sudan. But as the 9/11 Commission will later note, the Sudanese regime began to change. Though al-Turabi had been its inspirational leader, General Omar al-Bashir, president since 1989, had never been entirely under his thumb. Thus, as outside pressures mounted, al-Bashir's supporters began to displace those of al-Turabi. In 1995, the U.S. begins putting serious pressure on Sudan to deal with bin Laden, who is still living there. On March 8, 1996, the U.S. sends Sudan a memorandum listing the measures Sudan can take to get the sanctions revoked. The second of the 6 points listed is, provide us with names, dates of arrival, departure and destination, and passport data on Mujahideen that Osama bin Laden has brought into Sudan. Sudanese intelligence had been monitoring bin Laden since he'd moved there in 1991, collecting a vast intelligence database on Osama bin Laden and more than 200 leading members of his al-Qaeda terrorist network. The files include information on their backgrounds, families, and contacts, plus photographs. There also is extensive information on bin Laden's worldwide financial network. One U.S. source who has seen the files on bin Laden's men in Khartoum said some were an inch and a half thick. An intelligence officer with extensive Sudanese intelligence contacts says, "We knew all about them, who they were, where they came from. They had copies of their passports, their tickets. They knew where they went. Of course, that information could have helped enormously. It is the history of those people." To the surprise of United States officials making the demands, the Sudanese seemed receptive to sharing the file. This leads to a battle within the U.S. government between top FBI officials who want to engage the Sudanese and get their files, and Secretary of State Madeleine Albright and Susan Rice, her Assistant Secretary for Africa, who want to isolate them politically and economically. The National Security Council is also opposed. The United States decides to increase its demands and tells Sudan to turn over not just files on bin Laden, but bin Laden himself. Ultimately, the U.S. will get Sudan to evict bin Laden in May 96, but they will not press for the files, and they will not get them. An American involved in the secret negotiations later says, "I've never seen a brick wall like that before. Somebody let this slip up. We could have dismantled his operations and put a cage on top. It was not a matter of arresting bin Laden, but of access to information." That's the story, and that's what could have prevented September 11th. I knew it would come back to haunt us. Vanity Fair magazine later will opine, "How could this have happened?" The simple answer is that the Clinton administration had accused Sudan of sponsoring terrorism and refused to believe that anything it did to prove its bona fides could be genuine. The U.S. will continue to refuse Sudan's offers to take the files. May 18th, 1996, Sudan expels bin Laden. The United States fails to stop his flight to Afghanistan. See how all these things overlap? After pressure from the U.S., the Sudanese government asks bin Laden to leave the country. He decides to go to Afghanistan. He departs along with many other al-Qaeda members, plus much money and resources. Bin Laden flies to Afghanistan in a C-130 transport plane with an entourage of about 150 men, women, and children, stopping in Doha, Qatar, to refuel, where government officials greet him warmly. The U.S. knows in advance that bin Laden is going to Afghanistan, but does nothing to stop him. Sudan's defense minister later says in an interview, "We warned the U.S. In Sudan, bin Laden and his money were under our control, but we knew that if he went to Afghanistan, no one could control him. The U.S. didn't care, they just didn't want him in Somalia." It's crazy. U.S. al-Qaeda double agent Ali Mohammed handles security during the move. August 1996. Osama bin Laden issues a public fatwa or religious decree authorizing attacks on Western military targets in the Arabian Peninsula. This eliminates any doubts that bin Laden is merely a financier, rather he is an active militant. September 27, 1996, victorious Taliban, supported by Pakistan, viewed by U.S. and UNICAO as a stabilizing force. Taliban forces are conquering Afghanistan, establishing control. The Taliban conqueror Kabul, establishing control over much of Afghanistan. A surge in the Taliban's military successes at this time is later attributed to an increase in direct military assistance from Pakistan's ISI. The oil company UNICAO is hopeful that the Taliban will stabilize Afghanistan. Remember, it's a quagmire now. And allow its pipeline plans to go forward. According to some reports, preliminary agreement on the pipeline was reached between the Taliban and UNICAO long before the fall of Kabul. Oil industry insiders say the dream of securing a pipeline across Afghanistan is the main reason why Pakistan, a close political ally of America's, has been so supportive of the Taliban, and why America has quietly acquiesced in its conquest of Afghanistan. The 9/11 Commission later concludes that some State Department diplomats are willing to give the Taliban a chance because it might be able to bring stability to Afghanistan, which would allow a UNICAO oil pipeline to be built. September 1996, Bin Laden aligns with the Taliban. After their victory, Bin Laden arrives in Afghanistan on May 18th, after being expelled from Sudan. Initially, Bin Laden stays in an area not controlled by the Taliban, who are fighting for control of the country. But by the end of September 96, the Taliban conquer the capital of Kabul and gain control over most of the country. Bin Laden then becomes the guest of the Taliban. The Taliban, Bin Laden, and their mutual ally, Gulbadin Hekmatyar, then call for a jihad against Ahmad Shah Massoud, who retains control over a small area along Afghanistan's northern border. As Bin Laden establishes a new safe base and political ties, he issues a public fatwa authorizing attacks on Western military targets in the Arabian Peninsula. November 1996, late August 1998, the United States tracks Bin Laden's satellite phone calls. An Inmarsat Compact M satellite phone. During this period, Bin Laden uses a satellite phone to direct al-Qaeda's operations. The phone, a Compact M satellite phone about the size of a laptop computer, was purchased by a student in Virginia named Ziad Khalil for $7,500 using the credit card of a British man named Dr. Saad al-Faghi. After purchasing the phone, Khalil sent it to Khalid al-Fawaz, al-Qaeda's unofficial press secretary in London. Al-Fawaz then shipped it to Bin Laden in Afghanistan. Bin Laden's phone is believed to be used by other top al-Qaeda leaders as well, including Ayman al-Zawahiri and Mohammed Atef. Al-Fawaz also buys satellite phones for other top al-Qaeda leaders around the same time. Though the calls made on these phones are encrypted, the National Security Agency is able to intercept and decrypt them. As one U.S. official will put it in early 2001, codes were broken. The Los Angeles Times will report that the monitoring of these phones produced tens of thousands of pages of transcript over 2 years. Bin Laden's satellite phone replaces an older model he used in Sudan that apparently was also monitored by the NSA. Billing records for his new phone are eventually released to the media in early 2002. Newsweek will note a country-by-country analysis of the bills provided U.S. authorities with a virtual roadmap to important al-Qaeda cells around the world. The countries called are Britain, 238 or 260 calls. 27 different phone numbers are called in Britain. Accounts differ on the exact number of calls. Khalid al-Fawaz, who helps publish statements by Bin Laden, receives 143 of the calls. Apparently, most of the remaining calls are made to pay phones near him or to his associates. Yemen, 221 calls. Dozens of calls go to an al-Qaeda communications hub in Sana'a, Yemen, which is run by the father-in-law of 9/11 hijacker Khalid al-Midhar. Sudan, 131 calls. Bin Laden lived in Sudan until 96, and some important al-Qaeda operatives remained there after he left. Iran, 106. Newsweek will later report U.S. officials had little explanation for the calls to Iran. A Bush administration official said that the U.S. intelligence had believed for years that hardline anti-American factions inside Iran helped Bin Laden's organization operate an underground railroad smuggling Islamic militants to al-Qaeda training camps in Afghanistan.